How are things? Are you guys settling in? Did Neil give you a very inspirational talk? And he told you to disregard everything and just have fun? Okay. Maybe we are going to have a lot of fun, but you know, but since we are going to be, since I'm in charge, well, we are in charge of making sure you also get a degree from U of Waterloo. You know, we may have to play by some rules. So more about that later. Anyway, welcome to PSI. And so for most of you, this will be just a refresher course in complex analysis. Anyone amongst you who haven't seen complex analysis before? Okay. So I'm actually going to go through it as if most of you have seen it, but I'm putting my lecture notes online. So they're The first lecture is already on the wiki. So if you need more detail, please go and read through the lecture notes, okay? I am hardly an expert on this subject. I'm not a mathematician, so this will be a very much kind of a, you know, broad kind of using very broad brush strokes. I won't bother a lot about the subtleties that mathematicians worry about. Which is another way of saying that some of the question you might ask, I might not be able to give you the appropriate answer, or the answer to the, you know, to a degree of rigor that would satisfy you. All right. So as I said, no need to take lecture notes, because they're on the SciWiki. And you've all been able to log into the SciWiki, I presume. Okay, good. All right. So you guys probably know my name by now. And my room number is, and my email is the usual. So this is a refresher course in complex analysis. And I've looked at a few books, and I'm just going to quickly tell you what they are. And one is a very outline series book. It's a Shom's outline series by Spigel, and it's called The Theory and Problems of Complex Analysis. This is really good for to do examples. There are lots of examples. Not a lot of text. It doesn't go into a lot of the detail, but it has lots of examples. So you learn by doing examples. There's a lot of worked out examples, and there are a lot of examples that you can figure out yourself. And there's another one. This is a relatively new book by William, let me see, an I, T. Shaw, and this called Complex Analysis with Mathematica. Now, that's a really fun book, especially if you like pretty pictures. There's lots of pictures in the book, and the whole book has. The book is written with Mathematica. It comes with its own CD where you have each of the chapters as Mathematica notebooks. And all the pictures come with their own code as how you would actually draw the picture. And there are some good chapters on, you know, chaos and, you know, all the kinds of interesting pictures that you can draw with Mathematica. So for those who want to really play with Mathematica, this is a very, very good book. The book that I've been using a lot lately is a book by Ablowitz and Focus. And again, it's a complex analysis. Introduction and applications. Especially if you are interested in learning about branch cuts and branch points, this is the book to go to. And then lastly, this is not really a textbook, but a book which has some nice insights about some of the complex numbers which underlie some of the fundamental physics. And there's this tome by Roger Penrose called The Road to Reality. And he talks a little, you can just, the good thing about this book is that you can just zoom into some part and just read it. I mean, this book is like a, it's a paperweight. It's a door stopper, okay. It's a door stopper that can stop these heavy doors at PI, you know. So. All right, so so let's start with some, hand-waving motivation why we should really be interested in complex numbers. I feel that I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, but even then, no one actually talks about the essentialness of complex numbers when it comes to physics. I mean, physics textbooks don't somehow, talk about these things. Oh, that's very appropriate. So these are just a series of observations that I have collected over the years. But before that, the brief history of complex number is that Cardano, some Italian guy, discovered them in 1545. And he didn't really like them, but he was trying to solve a quadratic equation, and he had to introduce the notion of a square root of minus one. And so he grudgingly admitted the existence of the imaginary number. Cardano apparently also got into trouble with the law because he had drawn up a horoscope of Jesus Christ. So yeah, he is also remembered for that. I don't think that horoscope has survived as well as his other discovery, i.e. complex numbers. So one way of thinking about complex numbers is like the way that you can think of numbers as, say, rational numbers, integers, rational, irrational complex numbers as solutions of some polynomial equation or solution of some algebraic equation, right? So so the way Cardano, discovered complex number is like he was trying to solve a particular equation. So the question might come that, do you need to generalize complex numbers, say when we are trying to solve a cubic equation or a quartic equation? And the answer to that is no. That complex numbers are themselves, enough, and that's essentially the content of the fundamental theorem of algebra, which says that complex number form a what's the expression? I think algebraically complete. It's closed under algebraic operations. Yes, so, and. And when we'll see how this is, we'll see how this comes about when we talk about roots of unity later today. Okay, so before we delve into what kind of applications complex numbers can have in physics, I want to mention one simple example of why complex numbers are important, say, in real analysis or other branches of mathematics. And if you take this example of a function, and if you do, that this function will have a Taylor series expansion around zero, which has this form. But this expansion is valid only in a disk around the origin, open disk of unit radius. And you can, when you're doing real analysis, you can use a test of convergence and blah, blah to argue these things. But there's a very beautiful interpretation of why this series is only valid in that disk. And that's because if you think of it as a complex function, then this function has a singularity at plus I and minus I. And we know from a Taylor's theorem that Taylor series, converges in circles, and therefore, this gives us a geometric reason why the series doesn't converge, outside the disk. So, if you just draw a complex plane, there are these two poles, and that's why that means that the series is really valid in this open disk. And later on, we'll see a way of finding other series representation of this function. I mean, this function is simple enough that we don't need series representation to do computations. But but there might be functions which you do not have a simple expression, so you would actually have to do some sort of series expansion. And so later on, we'll see a way of figuring out the series expansion of a function outside, say this domain, say around, say, over here, some point, by doing what is known as an analytic extension. Okay, so anyone who kind of wants to, I'm not an expert on fractals and stuff, but if you look at with the way that a lot of these 2D fractals are generated, you'll find that they use a lot of complex numbers. So I'm not sure if that's essential to to fractals, or if that is just convenient. Does anyone know the answer to that? Do you actually need? Is there something about? For example, you can think of complex numbers as an ordered set of two real numbers, right? Is there a way of thinking of these fractals such that you don't actually need to use complex numbers? Anyway, just some question that just popped up in my mind right now. Okay, so let's talk about some applications of complex numbers in physics. And in physics, I don't think that before you come to quantum mechanics, that the world really needs complex numbers in an essential way. I mean, I'm sure that you've all seen that when you're doing waves and vibrations, introducing complex numbers is extremely convenient. But quantum mechanics actually uses complex numbers in an essential way. So, and why is that? Because the wave function in Schrodinger's equation, this guy is a complex object, and there's an I explicitly in Schrodinger's equation. Now let's take a moment and ask ourselves, what would happen if the Schrodinger's equation was a real equation, if there weren't any i's in it? Then he just observed that the Schrodinger's equation is first order in time and second order in space. Being first order in time, that means that it's kind of like a heat equation. So he, one of the characteristics of a heat equation is that it encodes a particular direction of time, right? Because it describes dissipation of heat, or so if Schrodinger's equation was were to be a real equation, then it would only describe it would actually impose a direction, an arrow of time on microscopic phenomena. But we know from experiments that if you look at reactions, between fundamental particles or quantum particles, a lot of them are, they are actually irreversible if you can isolate the system sufficiently. Sorry, they're reversible. And therefore, so what happens if you want to study the time reversal of Schrodinger equation is that, well, you put T2 minus T. But simultaneously, if you complex conjugate the equation, then you get back the Schrodinger's equation, but for the complex conjugate, wave function. So the price you have to pay to have a time reversible theory is that you have to complex conjugate this. Now, when you do quantum field theory, you will see that this actually implies that the particle that you are looking at is replaced by its antiparticle when you do the time reversal and the complex conjugation. And a very heuristic way of seeing that is that one way of studying charge, the dynamics of charged particle in non-relativistic quantum mechanics is to replace that operator, which say if I have h equals to 1, it's something like this. You replace that operator, I thought there was a plus, anyway, I always forget. You replace that operator by something like this, right? Where E is the charge of the particle, A is the vector potential, is a three-dimensional vector potential. So there, to get back the same Schrodinger equation, you actually have to reverse the, when you complex conjugate, you have to reverse the sign of the charge. But this is kind of built into the fabric of quantum field theory. So when you study relativistic quantum field theory, you will see that you are talking about a particle and its antiparticle at the same time. And the other assumption, of course, is that for this to be true, you also need a Hamiltonian, which is Hermitian, which means this is a real function. One of the PI is one of the few places where people actually think about what would the world look like if quantum mechanics had slightly different rules. So I've actually been to talks here about quantum mechanics done on real numbers. And there is no Schrodinger equation there. But in those quantum mechanics, it turns out it's not quite, you don't quite get our universe. That there are certain operations like charge conjugation, these things you cannot do, and also the quantum information that you get from real quantum mechanics, that is quantum mechanics over the real numbers, is very different from the quantum information theory that we are familiar with. So there are important differences. So some of you may have watched some of the PI lectures, Psi lectures by Carl Bender in previous years. So Carl Bender and his during his PhD with wrote this series of papers where what they did was that they took some Hamiltonian and which was exactly solvable, and then perturbed it by some small Hamiltonian, and then studied the energy as a as a complex function of the coupling of the perturbation parameter. And in Bender and Wu, which is FizRev, I think that you can access this paper from PI. What they showed was that the quantization of the energy level of quantum mechanics can be seen as, as a result of slicing through a Riemann surface associated with some complex energy function. So in some sense, what Carl Bender and Titi Wu was arguing is that somehow quantum mechanics, there's nothing quantum about quantum mechanics. It is quantum because we live in the real world, and therefore we have to project the energy eigenvalues down to some real axis. So the analogy that Carl uses is that the energy function is like a car park, but if you take a knife and cut across the car park, you just see discrete levels. So, and that kind of arises from quantum mechanics and the Riemann surfaces and stuff like that. So, if you are interested in this unorthodox and non-standard point of view, I should say, you should check out his paper. And then if you look at the basics of quantum field theory, the fundamentals. So deeper foundational questions of quantum field theory are related to the analyticity in the complex function sense of the correlation functions on their variables. And there's been, a lot of work was done in the 60s, 50s and 60s, I think, where they talked about S matrices and analyticity. But more recently, this has actually been, there's been a lot of research. For example, Freddy Cacciasso here, he works with exact results in quantum amplitudes. And there's a, the analytic properties of quantum field theories are extremely important in understanding those properties. In fact, the third year of PSI, that will be 2012, Freddy gave a few lectures where he kind of, introduced quantum field theory, from a much more axiomatic point of view. And when you try to, you can play this game where you want to ask how many of the foundational results in quantum field theory can be derived from, from assuming as little as possible. And it turns out, and if you kind of play those games, that the analytic properties of the correlation functions become very, very important. And there's also like complex numbers are actually also there in Einstein's relativity, so GR. So you're going to learn about relativity from Neil, and he's going to write down the Schwarzschild metric and other exact solutions of Einstein relativity. Now, given some boundary conditions, you have some solution, but the solution that you write down explicitly are usually given in some explicit coordinate system. And so you can ask, so as such, these coordinate systems system will only cover parts of the manifold. It will not be a global, it won't. So there will be another coordinate system which will cover some other aspect of the manifold. And the way that you basically go from one part of your manifold to another part of manifold, and you know, and sew together these different coordinate systems to get the global, you know, geometry of space-time, you know, is essentially an example. It's an application of analytic continuation, and again, physicists really don't care about mathematics, so they only care about solving problems. So they don't really talk about these things, apart from a few exceptions. So if you're interested in this aspect of analyticity of GR, then look at Brill's paper, GRQC. All right. Penrose's Twister program also uses complex numbers, and actually, it uses quaternions, which are a generalization of complex numbers, in an essential way. And Penrose started the Twister program to try to understand the structure of general relativity. In the Twister program, the light rays are the fundamental objects rather than the points in space-time. And since its invention or introduction by Penrose, twisters have influenced heavily many fields in mathematics and physics. And again, I would go back to what the work that Freddie is doing these days. You know, the amplitude people, they also use twisters quite a lot. So twisters are being used in quantum field theory quite a bit these days. And lastly, but not least, I would say that complex numbers are extremely important in string theory. Now, this theory may or may not be a description of our universe. You know, it's a bit of a controversial theory. But the way this happens is that, you know, a string kind of comes in and interacts with other string. You know, does something, and then goes away like this. So according to string theory, this is essentially like a fattening of the Feynman diagram of two particles coming in and interacting in some way, and then going away, right? But what happens is that this picture is actually related to something called a Riemann surface, which is a Riemann surface is an example of a two-dimensional complex manifold. So a complex manifold. This is described by this field in geometry called, you know, complex geometry. But so this is a torus or a genus one Riemann surface, and it turns out that, you know, you can think of it as a real manifold. But if you think of it as a complex manifold, then there are lots of different ways of thinking about it in a complex manifold. That there's actually a moduli. You can think of it as taking the complex plane and fixing one of the vectors to be 1, the other vector to be tau, and then, you know, making a lattice out of it. So you're just, you know, identifying this with this and this with this. But this choice of tau, this describes the complex, this describes what the complex structure of this manifold. And there are like inequivalent choices of tau, you know. And so what I'm trying to say is that the partition function of string theory, you know, the thing that you calculate stuff from, is going to have a sum over all the complex structures. It's actually a finite dimensional sum. You can show. And you know, this is the action. The minus I, right. So string theory, you know, the partition function of string theory, it, you know, involves a sum over all the complex structure on a Riemann surface. So, and that's essential for its consistency as a physical theory. So complex structures are built into the fundamental aspect of string theory. So there's another application of complex, you know, numbers in string theory, and I've been here long enough, but still get confused by these boards. So famously, string theory gets the dimension of space-time wrong, right? It tells you that it's 10-dimensional, but 10-dimension is equals to 6-dimension plus 4-dimension. So one way of resolving string theory with the real world is to hide 6 of this dimension on complicated compact manifolds, and it is required by the physical consistency of the theory that these 6-dimensional manifolds be something called Calabi-Yau manifolds. Now these are very, very complicated kind of, you know, 6-dimensional manifolds, which I'll draw like this. Stuff is happening. But these are dynamical manifolds, and there are, you know, and these are complex manifolds, and it turns out that, you know, you can deform the complex structures on this manifold in such a way that roughly, you know, you're changing the topology and the geometry of the cycles, right? Because, you know, think of it as some kind of fluctuating thing. And so, you know, so at every point in space-time, you are to imagine one of these guys. But as you move along the space-time, you know, one of these cycles can expand or contract, and that'll kind of, you know, so that could, essentially that you can think of it as some of these fluctuations as the fluctuations in the complex geometry of the manifold. But the way that these fluctuations manifest themselves in our 4-dimensional space-time is they look like scalar fields, complex scalar fields, that is charged scalar fields. So if string theory, of course, we don't see any of these scalar fields, and that's one of the big problems with string theory. The conjecture is that there is some mechanism which gives them mass, therefore they are, you know, very, very heavy and cannot be seen at LHC. But if string theory is to be proven true at some point, it'll be also kind of in a big, you know, it'll essentially prove that somehow, you know, geometry is complex at some fundamental level. Okay, so, okay, that was the fun part of the course. Any questions? Or why don't you guys tell me your favorite? Like what makes you like complex numbers, for example, or did you find any interesting link between, complex numbers and physics? These fluctuations would be, they would manifest themselves as massless scalars in our 4-dimensional world. But we don't really see these massless scalars in everyday life. So one way of resolving this is by introducing what are known as fluxes. So you basically wrap some, you know, flux tubes like Maxwell field strength or generalizations of them, and you can stabilize those geometry, and then that effectively gives a mass to your scalar field, and therefore you don't see them. They would be lying in the 6-dimensional space, yeah. So, okay. All right, so no one seems to have a... okay. Okay, I'm going to kind of skip over the basics, such as, you know, what is the, how you define a complex number and what is a complex conjugation, how to take divisions, unless someone wants me to. Does anyone want me to go through those? It's fine if you do, because I'll do it, you know. Going once, going twice? Okay, go on. Okay. Okay, so, I mean, complex numbers have a lot of geometry associated to them. What do I want to do? I want to get the front one down. Let's see if that works. So, you know, the complex plane is essentially, we have the real axis along the, and then we have, so let's represent a complex number as a point on this plane. So suppose this is Z. So we can think of the complex number as a two-dimensional vector with the X component given by A, the Y component given by B. So B is the imaginary part of Z. So B is actually a real number. The imaginary part of the complex number is actually real. Then, of course, we can represent the addition of two complex numbers as the addition of two vectors, two 2D vectors. So this gives a geometric interpretation to the addition of complex numbers. And you know, the vector addition is defined in any arbitrary dimension, but there's actually a geometric interpretation to the multiplication of complex numbers. And that's not something you get in every dimensions. So this is kind of, you know, related to division algebras. There are only four algebras which allow division, and they're only and they all come with their own very rich and interesting geometry. So if you take two complex numbers, Z1 and Z2, and multiply them together, then essentially it has the same, this has a geometrical interpretation. The interpretation is that if you just took, you know, a triangle whose endpoints are 0, 1, and Z1, so 0, 1, and suppose this is, oh, I'm gonna run out of space here. So this is, say, our triangle. Then the triangles 0, Z2, and Z1 and Z2, sorry, 0, yeah. So if you take a point here, say Z2, and then draw this, and this is Z1 and Z2, then these two triangles are similar triangles. Right. And this is basically the interpretation of, and this will become clear why this is the case when we look at the Euler formula and its geometric interpretation. To get to that, it's useful, like one of the things, so I wasn't a very good student in high school. I basically didn't go to class. But one of the things I do remember from high school is that when you multiply a number by I, it rotates it counterclockwise by 90 degrees. Now, that's probably the only thing I remember from high school. Our high schools are only 2 years, grade 11 and 12. I should get that edited out. So we can think of multiplication as an operation. And the operation is that whenever you multiply a number, which is represented on the complex plane by a vector, whenever you multiply it by I, you rotate that vector by 90 degrees counterclockwise. So example is we take 1, then I takes us 90 degrees counterclockwise. If you rotate again by I, it takes us to minus 1, minus I, then plus 1. So now this begs the question, at least in my mind, that is there a complex number which rotates any arbitrary number by an arbitrary angle? And you already know the answer to that. And so okay, before I give you the answer, which you know already, let's just build up to it. So we can write our complex numbers in polar coordinates. And it turns out that by going over to the polar coordinates on the complex plane, the Argand vessel plane, we actually unlock the geometry of complex numbers. So R is a real number. And what R is, R is the length. So if this is our number, R is this length, and theta is this angle, then we can represent Z in that fashion. Now, if you use the Taylor series expansion of cosine and sine and the formal expansion of the exponential series, then we can write this as, and this is the, you know, this tells us that e to the power I theta is cosine of theta plus I sine of theta. And this is the famous Euler formula. And this shows that if you take e to the power I phi, the phase, and multiply any number, then essentially that rotates that the vector associated that by that number by the angle theta. Right. So apocrypha. I think, before I give you the apocrypha, let me tell you what Feynman said. Feynman said, this formula is our jewel, the most remarkable formula in mathematics, as if Feynman knew mathematics. Anyway, he knew more than me, I'm sure. But yeah. But there, now the apocrypha is that, Euler was the court mathematician of Catherine the Great. So, you know, because some things haven't changed. You know, academics still have to go around the world to find jobs. So, the famous encyclopedist Denis Diderot was visiting Catherine the Great's court, and Diderot had the reputation of being an atheist, which was so Catherine the Great apparently wanted Euler to somehow insult Diderot. And Euler used this formula as proof of God's existence. I don't know how true this is, so that's why I'm saying it's apocrypha. Okay. So, given the Euler formula and given the interpretation that if you multiply by e to the power I phi, you rotate a vector by the angle theta, we can now understand what was happening in that in the geometric interpolation multiplication. Basically, when you multiply it by Z2, we can think of Z2 as, well, Z2 has a modulus part and a phase part, and this theta 2, this part rotated the number 0, 1, and Z1 by the angle theta 2, and R2 scaled everything. And that's why, you know, the two triangles are similar. I mean, if R2 was 1, then of course there would be, the two triangles would be identical. What's the English word? Congruent. Yes, that's the word. Congruent. Sorry, I didn't learn these things in the English language. So now the Euler formula kind of sneaks in a lot of interesting things into the subject. And notice that the Euler formula is defined for value of theta between 2 pi and 0. However, you know, if you extend the domain of theta from 0 to 2 pi to the real line, then the Euler formula tells you that Z is a periodic function of theta, right? Right. So in other words, you know, if we can write Z as the modulus where n is some integer. So in this case, you know, I'm taking theta to be between 0 and 2 pi. And but if we just add these multiples of 2 pi to theta, you know, it doesn't change the value of Z. So the argument of a complex number, this theta here is called the argument of a complex number. Right? So I'm just right. Right, okay. So I'll just, you know, because I'm restricting theta to be between 0 and 2 pi, you know, I'll just write this because the argument of the complex of a given complex number can be this angle theta, which is between 0 to 2 pi, and any, you can add to it any multiples of 2 pi n. The value of theta that is between 0 and 2 pi is sometimes called the principal argument, and some people put a p there to specify that this is the theta between 0 and 2 pi. Another notation is big ARG of Z means theta of pi. That is big ARG argument is this arg with n equals to 0. So these are just notations so that, you know, people, when we are doing calculations, you know, you can be unambiguous about certain things. So, So next, let us see how to compute the roots of unity, or which lies at the heart of the fundamental theorem of algebra. So, you know, before we figure out how to compute the roots of unity, complex numbers allow you to prove de Moivre's theorem very easily. I should say, the Euler formula allows you to prove de Moivre's theorem very, very easily. And de Moivre's theorem is cosine of theta I sine of theta raised to a power n, where n is an integer, is given by cosine n of theta plus I sine n of theta. And if you use the Euler formula, this just follows trivially. So we want to solve roots of unity. That is, suppose we have we want to solve this equation. Where n is an integer. So given a complex number, you're given a complex number omega and an integer n, you want to find out what z is, or what are the z values of z that, you know, satisfies this equation. So to do this, let's write our complex number that is we are given in the Euler form, paying particular attention to the principal value. Then we have z is, if you take the nth root of this equation, okay. Now notice that when k is for k 0, 1, 2, dot, dot, n minus 1, these are all distinct numbers, okay? So these are the roots of, you know, of this equation, okay? But when k, you know, goes to n equals, so n equals to, when k is n, you get back to the same root as when k is 0. And these set of numbers have a very nice geometrical interpretation. And you can think of them as, you know, if you draw a circle around the origin whose radius is r to the power 1 over n, then these numbers give you points, and the angle between each of these points of these guys is 2 pi over n, essentially, you know, 2 pi over n, this value. This gives you a very nice geometric interpretation of these numbers. And so for example, Suppose I want to figure out the cube root of unity. So in this case, my complex number is 1. Then the solutions of this equation are 1 e to the power 2i pi by 3 and e to the power 4i pi by 3. And geometrically, we have a circle of unit radius, and there's the point 1 here. And this guy is 120 degrees over here, and this guy is 240 degrees. Excuse my circle. But now, see, if you take this vector and this vector, and you add them up, you essentially get, this vector, yes. You get this vector. Sorry, my drawing is not the best. Let me call this guy omega, then this guy is omega squared. Then what I'm trying to say is that 1 plus omega, which is this guy plus this guy, is going to give you minus omega squared, or 1 plus omega squared is 0. Now, you can apply Euler formula now to omega and write this out in terms of, and you'll get some, the real part and the complex part of this equation will give you some, complicated relationship between angles and stuff like that, right? But having a geometric interpretation, you can, write down formulae like this much more easily. Okay, so enough of, fundamental stuff. Now let's do something a little bit more interesting. And let's talk about Riemann surfaces. So the argument function that we looked at, it's theta p plus 2 pi k, right? So this is an example of a function that is multivalued. So I give you a point on your complex plane, you get a bunch of numbers out. So as such, if you, how do I say that? Right. So there is a way of modifying extending the domain of our complex function in such a way that the resulting function that we get is single-valued in the image. And this is basically where, and the way of extending the domain of our function is, results in a two-dimensional surface, which is known as the Riemann surface. And let me do some examples to clarify this. Let's take the square root function. So the square root function is essentially this thing. Or if I want to be more explicit, So there is a theta by 2, which is important here. Now, if I consider a small circle around the origin, and I go around the circle, then my angle theta will increase. But as theta goes from 0 to 2 pi, we see that this function does not come back to itself. Right? It comes back to minus of the value that was at theta equals to 0. So clearly, this function is not single valued, and therefore it's discontinuous. Right? But if you go another 2 pi, so if when theta goes from 2 pi to 4 pi, then we come back to the same value of the function as when theta was equals to 0. There are even more drastic examples of this phenomena. And to see that, take the log of z. So the log of z is defined as the log of the modulus of z plus I theta p plus 2 pi k. Right? So this definition of log of z follows from the expression of the complex number in terms of its polar coordinate, right? And here you see that for a given z, this is an infinitely, this function was, double valued, whereas this function has an infinite number, infinitely valued function. So very, very, very frequently these multi-valued functions arise whenever you're trying to take inverse functions of some frequently used functions, such as things which are raised to some power, like integer power, or in this case the exponential of a complex number, right? So I told you that there's a way to fix things such that our functions will no longer be multivalued. And rather than giving you a general theory of Riemann surfaces, which I cannot do even if I wanted to, I will tell you how to do this in these two examples. So coming back to our example where we have square root of z is square root of r e to the power I theta by 2. I told you that when we go around a small circle around the origin, if you go around once, this function does not come back to itself. It picks up a minus sign. Such a phenomena in mathematics is called monodromy. And we say that this function has a monodromy around the point z equals to 0. If you have a function and you suspect that it has a monodromy around some point, how are you going to figure that out? Suppose you suspect the function has a monodromy around some point z0, then you basically have to expand the function around z, do a Taylor expansion, where you write your complex coordinate, your complex variable z, in terms of real, some small, let's put an epsilon, some real small number times I of theta. and then vary theta from 0 to 2 pi to see that if that you get back the same expression. If you don't, then that function has a monodromy around that particular point z naught. So for this function, you might ask, does it have a monodromy, say, around this point, some point other than 0? To see that, you know, you choose a circle like this, and you will see that, you know, when you go around, when you go around this point in a circle, your angle, your polar angle is going to go from theta 1 to theta 2, and then it's going to come back to theta 2 to theta 1. In this, you know, in this formula, the monodromy, you know, came from the fact that theta had a half multiplying it, so that when you when theta went around 2 pi, theta by 2 went around to, from 0 to pi. Right? So here you see that as you go around the circle, you know, theta actually comes back to its own the original value. And therefore, we see that there is not going there is not going to be a monodromy of the square root function around some point that is not the origin. Okay? So the points around which, you know, your function have has monodromy is known as a branch point. So in this case, the branch point is the origin. So the way that we are going to turn this multivalued function into a single-valued function is by doing surgery on C. So what this means that we take two copies of our complex plane. And this is the origin, this is the origin. And so as we go from 0 to 2 pi, what we do is that we interpret that function as taking value in another complex plane. So what we do is that we, starting from the branch point and going off to infinity, we introduce a cut, and we identify the two complex plane, you know, along these, you know, along these cuts. But we do it in a peculiar way that when you're approaching this cut from, say, the lower part, you emerge in this other complex plane on the upper part. And when you approach the, you know, this cut from the lower part of this complex plane, you are taken to this upper part. So in other words, if we choose our, you know, if we choose our, so we can write this guy as r e to the power I theta p by 2 and e to the power I pi n. So we allow theta to be from 0 to 2 pi, but as long as we are on this, we, you know, so this, okay. the multi-valuedness of this of the function is now translated into saying that this function actually takes its value on two different complex planes. And that is what I meant by, you know, extending the domain of definition and each of these complex planes being, you know, labeled by this integer n. Okay. So this is an example of a Riemann surface. And the cut that we made, along which we identified the two surface, the two complex plane, is called a branch cut. In not tomorrow's tutorial, but the day after, we'll do quite a long problem involving branch cuts and branch points. So, you know, it's historically it's been a very a lot of there's a lot of discussion in that tutorial. So, but one of the things I wanted to tell you is that a branch cut is a branch point is something that is intrinsic to the function, whereas the branch cut is depends on how you parameterize your function in terms of theta, because you know this theta we could have chosen to measure our angle not from the real axis but from the imaginary axis, and that would you know that would give rise to a different you know branch cut. Interestingly, in this whole business, one talks a lot about the point at infinity, right? And again, in tomorrow's tutorial, we'll give a geometric interpretation to the point of infinity. But the way that one studies how a function behaves at the point at infinity is by doing a simple change of variable. You'll see, and you probably all of you probably know this already. The point at infinity is actually can be thought of, if you think of the origin as being the south pole of a sphere, which has been projected onto the complex plane through stereographic projection, then the point at infinity is the north pole in the other stereographic projection. And you will do it in great detail in tomorrow's tutorial, okay? But most complex analysis books don't tell you about this. They tell you, oh, there's this point at infinity, and the way we do it is we define some new coordinate, and then, you know, look at our function in terms of this new coordinate, right? So then our, you know, we have, you know, this guy becomes, you know, 1 over, there's a minus sign here, right? So what does this tell us? Is there a branch point at infinity? Is there? Yes, because there's a theta by 2, right? So as you go around the point at infinity, which in this, you know, in this, in this form is the point at t equals to 0, you also pick up a minus sign, and therefore there is a... So the branch cut essentially goes from this point at origin to infinity, okay? But we could have chosen our parameterization in such a way that the branch cut could have taken the negative axis to infinity, or it could have taken some very complicated, you know, path up out to infinity. A lot of times when you're doing physics, the choice of your branch cut is determined by your physical problem. Okay, so last is that the similar to the square root function, the logarithm also has a branch point at the origin. So let's write this out. Log of z is log of the mod of z, and then I theta, let's just write theta for now. This is theta p plus 2 pi k, right? So if you look at a circle of a fixed radius around the origin, and you go around that circle, then of course this thing doesn't change because it's just the radius of that circle. But as you go around, you're adding 2 pi. Once you go, when you go around 2 pi on your original circle, you're adding 2 pi to this function. And you keep on adding 2 pi. So the one way of dealing with this function to make it single valued is to take an infinite number of copies of the complex plane and cut along the positive real axis and sew them together. So this looks like an infinite helix, not like a car park that goes up and down. It's like one of those Borges staircases. So this is an infinitely sheeted Riemann surface. So the formal definition of a Riemann surface is that it is a complex manifold which locally looks like C. And these guys always in some local neighborhood will just look like a harmless copy of C. But globally, it's not C. That is the formal definition of a Riemann surface. Because in the context of this course, this is basically what we are calling Riemann surfaces, essentially, multiple copies of C cut and pasted together. But in geometry, you are probably familiar with Riemann surfaces which have higher genus, things like that. So for example, a torus, or a sphere, or a double torus, those are also Riemann surfaces because they also look locally like some complex plane, but globally they have a very different topology. Okay, so right. I think I'm going to stop here. Any questions?
Defining the Riemann surface is really like changing the domain.
Right. Yeah.
We no longer restrict our
Exactly. Yeah. And a lot of people don't really. You don't actually have to use the for like practical integrals doing computations. You actually don't need Riemann's. You just have to be aware of this multi-valuedness. So this is more kind of to have a more geometric. It's just to explore the geometry that is implicit in complex functions. You get this beautiful sort of, surfaces.
Are there any examples that this kind of concept becomes really crucial on the calculation process?
In these cases, yeah. I mean, I think if you end up taking the string theory exploration courses, I think Pedro Vieira, he does a lot of computations. I don't know how essential they are. I mean, As I said in string theory, not these kind of Riemann surfaces, but the other Riemann surfaces play a fundamental role. There you can't get away from them. The string world sheet is actually a complex manifold. The thing is that two toruses, which are distinct as complex manifolds, are actually not distinct as real manifolds. Because a complex manifold is a much more restrictive object, it's kind of related to what we will see tomorrow about the Cauchy-Riemann equation. So when you say a function satisfies the Cauchy-Riemann equation, that implies that you're imposing a notion of differentiability on your function, which is more restrictive than the real sense of differentiability. And in the case of geometry, something like that happens is that two complex manifolds who are not diffeomorphic to each other are diffeomorphic as real manifolds. So, and in string theory, you actually sum over all these complex structures of these complex manifolds. So, you know, so your result actually does depend on that. Okay. Anything else? Okay. If not, I'll see you guys bright and early at 9 o'clock tomorrow. Oh, just suggestion: if you come a little bit earlier and get your order in by 8:30 for your breakfast, that helps greatly arriving at class on time. Okay. And thanks, Caleb, for the correction. The quiz had a typo, which I've corrected. The result of the quiz had a typo.